episode.
Every time the Avatar ride plays, do you...
every time that 20-minute loop. I could retire.
There you go. Money just starts raining down from the heavens.
Nerdappropriate.com. This is episode number 273, and I'm your host, Matt.
And I'm Ash.
And we have a special episode today.
Scott's missing.
That's what's special about it.
Oh, yeah.
It's special. There's no Scott.
Oh, my gosh. Where is that guy?
Scott had to move, which is very true. He had to move.
Right.
And a landslide of boxes fell on him while he was moving. And I've heard he still has not made it out. So...
He's digging his way out of boxes.
Yeah, everybody, there's going to be a GoFundMe for him to help extract Scott from the boxes. And,
the reality is, since Scott has been moving, he has been, like, incommunicado. So yeah. We actually have no idea what the hell's up with Scott or where he is. I've never seen the moving process absorb someone so much as this one. So,
well, we can't all be pros like me, you know. Once you move cross-country four times, it becomes a breeze.
Many, many times. I've been in the same house for, like, decades, so I don't even know what moving's about anymore.
I think you've moved, like, my washing machine, like, three times, though, like a champ.
Yeah. I normally lay on the sword for my friends and move stuff around. I actually don't mind. It's decent exercise most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think once you and I did it, just you and me and my dad, right? Didn't we?
Yeah.
When I moved out of the duplex,
apartment. Yeah. I helped at the apartment move. Yeah,
I've moved way too much in my
life. Lifting boxes.
Yeah.
Hey, we have a special episode other than Scott not being here.
Yeah.
So, Frieda Wolf's here.
What? And,
yeah, Frieda Wolf's awesome. So for those of you who have been following the show for a long time, you guys are probably aware that we are fans of the Mass Effect franchise, and Frieda Wolf voices Sarah Ryder in Mass Effect Andromeda and tons of other stuff, which we'll talk about. And she is just a joy to talk to, and she has a really cool history. She was a dev for a long time, and she actually talks a little bit about game development and some of the
audio engineering.
Yeah, and some of the good things and bad things about game dev. So I think if you are interested at all in the world of video games, you will definitely enjoy our talk with Frieda Wolf.
Yeah, she was great to talk to, and I say let's not delay any further.
Let's do it.
Here is our interview with Frieda Wolf.
Hey, everybody. We are here with Frieda Wolf, who is the voice of Sarah Ryder in Mass Effect Andromeda, and she's going to hang out with us on Sunday. How you doing, Frieda Wolf?
I am in Alien Covenant recovery.
Oh, man.
I'm fine. I'm good. I'm a dick.
Why are you a dick?
I'm a dick because I was 15 minutes late to this podcast, which has never happened before, and I'm so embarrassed about. But my nerd senses went into overdrive because a brand new Aliens movie came out this weekend, and I did my nerd duty, and I went and saw the film, which means I, of course, immediately went home and stayed up till 5 a.m, reading everything I could about the movie and watching the extras and reading people's analyses with my head up my own butt, which made me completely forget everything else in the real world. So I am a dick, officially,
for the record. If you're on the right podcast, if watching an alien film is your excuse for being late, so that is it's my go-to answer for my favorite film of all time is Aliens. And I saw that you were tweeting all sorts of stuff about it, and I was just eager to kind of pick your brain and hear what you thought about it before we got started and started talking specifically about you. So what did you think of the new Alien film?
It is a solid 7 as a film. But you have to go in treating it as an independent film of the Alien franchise, because I'm already calling it, it's an AVP film. It's Alien versus Prometheus. It is not part of the standalone independent Alien franchise. If you go in expecting an Alien movie, you will be upset. If you go in and you're like, you know what, I'm in the mood for some sort of some sci-fi horror, probably directed by a more mature gentleman who knows what he's doing, who can probably do a solid job, then you'll be satisfied. But don't go in expecting an alien movie, because that's not what you're going to get. And furthermore, if you're like me and you prefer Aliens by James Cameron over Alien by Ridley Scott, you're not going to get Aliens. There are a lot of callbacks to original Alien, which is fine, but it's just that's a very different vibe. I spent a lot of time getting annoyed, like I do in AVP, Alien vs. Predator movies, where when they try to build up the characters to in 15 minutes or less, you're going to love these characters or your money back. No, I'm not.
And you're like, who the hell was that when they died? You don't even know the guy's name.
You know what? Yeah. I forgot who all died. Like, I went home and started doing the thing where I start going through trivia and the cast list. I've put myself on media blackout since Prometheus. Prometheus broke me because their marketing included doing trailers for the trailers for the trailers. And I ate it all up. And then Prometheus itself was so deflating because I don't think much of the story. I think Prometheus is a great movie to watch on mute in the background. If you don't know what they're saying at all, or maybe if you put it on in Russian, it will seem, maybe if you put it on in like in a language that you don't speak, it will seem a lot more esoteric and intelligent than it is, because it is a gorgeous film.
It is a very beautiful, it's a beautiful film. But beyond that, you know, I remember leaving, I only saw it the one time in the theater, which is strange because I love all the Alien films. But
same.
Yeah, but I remember leaving the theater being like, huh, like what happened to the second half of that movie?
Wait, I own the art book for Prometheus.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so gorgeous, and the... anybody who's even remotely an H.R. Giger fan really gets off on seeing the evolution of the xenomorphs, because every time there's a new film, we establish, you know, new breeds of xenomorph and all that stuff, and that's all great.
It brings me a lot of joy that you are such a nerd for Aliens, because it is, you know, a franchise that's close to my heart. So I think you're in the right place, even though you were 15 minutes late.
Sorry. My brain is always 15 minutes late. Ask anybody who's worked with me.
Oh, it's completely fine. I'm just giving you a hard time.
I deserve it. No, it's definitely a good popcorn film, and it's a solid 7, but it's the Chronicles of David. And it made me Jones really hard to go home and immediately watch Event Horizon and the Chronicles of Riddick. And some people take that as an insult. I don't, because I like those films a lot.
I
watch
Event
Horizon a few times a year. I own Chronicles of Riddick action figures. Like, I like those films. They're fun for me.
They're good. I love Pitch Black too. I thought that was great too.
Oh, Pitch Black was you know what? A lot of this nerdery comes from the fact that generationally those films were important. When between the ages, I mean, I've gone back and thought about this, and you know how like people who are in their 40s, early 50s will talk a lot about like summer of 1980, summer of 1982, and really, really big films like E.T. and Empire Strikes Back and whatever, Close Encounters, those summer blockbusters when those movies hit and those people were young. It really, it digs in your brain. And then a lot of those people for whom it hits home the hardest, they end up working in entertainment. For my summers between ages 15 and 16, the films I saw in theaters, I saw Fifth Element in the theater 7 times when I was 15. Same year, Starship Troopers.
Oh my God, Starship Troopers. I saw that in the theater as well. That blew my mind when it first came out. I remember just absolutely loving every second of that.
1998 was also Event Horizon. The following year was Dark City.
Matrix was right around that time too.
Matrix was a couple years after that. It was like 98, 99.
Yeah.
So those were all my summers. Those are my summer movies. So of course, like very, very much sucked in. Even I saw Alien Resurrection when it came out in the theater too. Genet, that director who also did Delicatessen, Amelie, Micmacs, like a ton of other films, that French director definitely put his stank on it, and it was very much his film. I still have impression. It wasn't maybe the most, that wasn't much of an Alien film. Although, as I was going to I was failing going to sleep last night because I was obsessing. There are also a lot of similarities in themes between Alien Resurrection and Covenant as far as deeply fetishizing the xenomorphs and sort of elevating them into like perfect deity god status, where you put them before before the needs of mankind, because you should bow down to this perfect organism, et cetera, et cetera. And that sort of fetishizing beyond sexuality. It is like we should all bow down, like, you know, Mayan sacrificing and beheading and all that sort of thing. Still not an alien film, though.
Yeah.
And they too many characters that they worked too hard to pump you up about in 15 minutes before killing them off. And I didn't even pick up, like, for example, Covenant had a lot of extras online. And like I said, I've been a very good girl since Prometheus, and I put myself on a blackout. Any film that I know I'm going to see in the theater, I will not watch the trailers. I will watch trailers for things that I'm probably not going to watch.
See, that's very disciplined. I don't know if I could do that. I get way too excited.
I went into Mad Max Fury Road blind. I thought from all I saw were billboards and stuff, and like I'd close my eyes if I was in a movie and they were forcing the trailer before. I did that last night for Valerian, because I'm obviously my big Luc Besson fan because of Fifth Element. I thought because of the marketing, I thought Charlize Theron was like the villain, and I was actually kind of bummed out when she wasn't the bad guy.
Really?
I thought she was the bad guy from all the billboards and stuff, and I was like, "Oh, that's fine." But
I don't know if I could ever do that. I don't think I could. I usually skip the last couple trailers because it starts to give away plot after a while. After trailer two, trailer three, you're like, "I'm seeing half the movie." Usually, trailer one I watch multiple times though.
My point with last night, so like after I got home, that's when I started digging through them. Like I knew there was a like they made a little quickie 2-minute clip with Naomi Rapace and Fassbender as like a 2-minute clip to introduce Covenant coming over from Prometheus. And then I watched trailers and stuff, and oh my God. So the little 2-minute clip was fine. In fact, half of that is in the film itself. The trailer was a bunch of stuff that's not in the film, so it's kind of selling you a different movie, followed by pretty much the entire movie.
Wow.
Damn near the whole movie is in the trailer for Covenant, which is infuriating and a shame and makes me feel good about refusing to watch trailers. And I posted that on Twitter, and some people jumped in of like, I wished I hadn't seen the trailer because I went in the movie and I was like, there was nothing left.
Jeez. Well, we could actually do an entire episode on this, but I do have to ask you about you because that's why people are here.
There's Aliens movie out.
I know. Let's just talk about Aliens the whole time. No, I actually, it's funny. You started talking about it a little bit earlier about, you know, some of the movies you grew up on. But in terms of your voice work, did you grow up watching a lot of cartoons? Like, did you realize that you kind of had a voice early on, the ability to kind of, you know, portray characters and such? Because I know you kind of entered voice acting later in your life. You didn't start when you were like 15.
Yeah,
you know?
I switched at age 30.
That's awesome. That is really awesome. So were you like a big fan of cartoons and such growing up?
Back in my day, and I presume also your day,
yeah.
When we all watched TV as a generation, and if you didn't have cable, you only had the primary channels that were given to you, wherever you are in the world, Canada, United States, etc. We were all locked in and subject to Saturday morning cartoons.
Yes.
And after school specials, and you know, the after school cartoon hour starting at 3 o'clock with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and whatever else. And so I grew up again, you know, being subjected to the same entertainment plot points that the rest of us are up until now, where it's like you go in a restaurant and they've sat the tablet in front of the child for the next 2 hours so he can be mesmerized watching reruns of Dora or whatever.
Right.
Like growing up in his own little bubble of what cartoons will make an impression on him, which is weird when you think about it. That's another deep dig there.
Yeah.
So I grew up with cartoons of the 80s and 90s, especially with the Hasbro toy push. Back in the day, anybody can read into this, cartoons only existed to push merchandising. Toy lines were designed first for exactly like all the Hasbro lines, He-Man, She-Ra, G.I. Joe, they would design the toy lines first and then try to build a show around them so they could sell the toys. To this day, we're now in a situation where they don't merchandise the toys as hard, and when the cartoon itself doesn't sell ad space, they just move it to YouTube. Cartoon Network has certainly done a lot of that, where they'll just put series directly to YouTube and have like their own independent streaming service, which again a lot of channels have done. So I grew up watching what everyone else watched. I was definitely aware of the the flexibility of Mel Blanc, for example, because I would watch and read the credits like every time old school Looney Tunes was come on, and it's like Mel Blanc, everything. What?
One dude. That's true. He was he was in so many things.
Yeah, and there will never be another Mel Blanc because one, very few people. I think like Eric Bauza comes close. Eric Bauza is another voice actor who. He's not of this earth. He can do so many impressions well, and not just like imitate people's voices, but also be able to perform and act with them. He's unrealistically talented. But also with Mel Blanc as an example, I think we're happily in a position where a white guy can't capitalize that hard on all the parts,
right?
Because it looks bad. And it is bad to be that homogenous in your casting. I see a lot of parts go out in auditions where they actually want one more often than not. Now, like if they have a Latina character, they want an actual Latina. I happen to be half Mexican and speak fluent Spanish, so I get a lot of those roles coming my way. Or it's important to casting where if they want someone. That's the only time, like when people have asked me, can I do voiceover because right. I'm only XYZ. Even something as seemingly exotic as transgender or whatever. And it's like, well, it's not about necessarily who you are unless they want something specific like country of origin and they want the accent to be authentic. But honestly, most of the time, it's not that. They just want someone who sounds good, regardless right. of your age, gender, point of origin. So I was aware, hyper aware of Mel Blanc and then Animaniacs, because those actors I know like took a lot of turns and the skits were so varied, and the humor was so adult. Even as a little kid, I knew a lot of the jokes were like, when I was in the fourth grade, I hadn't seen Goodfellas, but when those pigeons came on, I knew there was like multi-layer humor there. And right. that it was
yeah, Animaniacs was incredible. I actually watched an old episode recently and it still is good. Like even, you know, many, many years later, it's still a fantastic show.
They weren't shy about writing good scripts suffering them to talk down to children, presuming children are dumb. Like they gave children the benefit of the doubt of like, look, you'll have a good time. And even if you don't get it, your parents will.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, they probably realized that parents would be watching it with their children. So they kind of threw the parents a bone here and there.
Oh, it's nice. Like you always have such a better result if you trust your audience to follow you along and don't talk down and dumb yourself down for the audience. I find. I also feel less insulted. So, I mean, I was a kid, I was aware of that, but it wasn't doing voices and making sound wasn't something I practiced. I actually like grew up in a pretty repressed home only because my father was an actor in the 50s and 60s. He was in a bunch of Jane Mansfield movies. He acted mostly out of, I believe Fox Studios had some studios out of England and blah, blah, blah. But he was like a failed, burned out, bitter actor. And those feelings were always projected onto me as a kid. And my mom being like a hardcore Mexican Catholic conservative in the old, and I've had this conversation with a lot of first generation immigrant kids in the old country, whatever country that is. If you do not have a university degree, you are no one and nothing. You have no respect. You have no prestige. You have no potential. You will go nowhere in life. You are garbage. So they look down on artists pretty hard. I'm a bit older. I mean, hopefully that's changed like in the last 15 years, but if you didn't have to that point, my mother's father in Mexico had 10 brothers and sisters. All of the men were forced. The father was a district judge, and the mother was she was picked up in a convent. Father saw her through a keyhole looking into the patio and said, "I'll take that one." She was 13 and put to work as a breeding cow at age 13 and had 11 children during the Mexican Revolution and all this stuff.
Oh my God.
And the boys were all forced to have to get either degrees as a doctor, engineer, or a lawyer. Those were the only options. My grandfather was a lawyer. The rest were doctors and engineers. The four women were forced to become chemists because at that point, the only career path that women could get into and become extremely profitable, which the four aunts did, was as pharmacists. So they so they got their degrees in chemistry because like women still, they couldn't, they could push to be doctors, but you'd never like really practice and no one would really trust you. So they pushed to become chemists. They opened up a chain of pharmacies in Mexico City and bought up property like crazy. So in the old country, you have prestige when you have a traditional job and with a traditional college degree, so you can make money the traditional way and then do other traditional, predictable, understandable things like buy up real estate. That all makes sense to people, you know, with 19th century thinking. But if you say, I want to be an artist of any kind, for that generation, it immediately calls to mind fucking scenes from... what's it called? Ugh, that film with Ewan McGregor and Nicole Kidman and the Baz Luhrmann, the singing and the dance.
What's it called? Why can't I remember
Moulin Rouge?
Yeah. It recalls scenes of Moulin Rouge where like everyone's living in poverty and wearing eyeliner and singing about opium and sex and living in brothels. And that is what being an artist means, which is stupid. There is no dignity, honor, and glory in being a starving artist. You should always make art so you can make money. And once you have it going as a commercial artist and you have your safety net and you're paying your rent and everything's good and you have some savings, that is the time when you are, and at that point you are also presumably at your best health. Because you're not stressed and worried about making money or whatever, that's when you can make time and you can afford to make your personal art and make your fine art. The difference between commercial and fine artists is fine artists do whatever the hell they want. No one gives them art direction. They're not working for anyone but themselves. Fine artists are the ones with gallery exhibitions and then present to people their collections and people will buy them for whatever motivation, because a piece moves them or because they're looking for an investment or whatever. A commercial artist works for someone else. I am a commercial artist as a voice actor. I am reading other people's scripts. If I was a fine artist, I would be producing my own scripts. I would be pitching my own shows. I would be working. I would be writing scripts in-house for game designers. I don't do any of that because I'm lazy and I like the money. So I'm a commercial artist, so I work to serve other people. That also makes me much more comfortable than someone who has to convince you that their ideas are good.
Right, right. So is your family and extended family okay with what you're doing now? Is there still pushback or are they content now that you're doing well?
They're all dead. I'm totally listening. It's like
that ends the podcast. We'll see you next time.
They're dead. I killed them. No, part of this first generation immigrant mentality is something even like, so recently I did Paradigm, which is a point and click adventure game that's made by a child, Jacob Generica, who's like 20, I'm not even sure he's 25 years old yet. He's out of Australia and we connected a lot because his parents are Polish, from Poland. He's first generation Australian. Jacob plays the protagonist, who looks like a mutated thumb and talks, and the whole universe of Paradigm is like this Eastern Bloc, Eastern European post-apocalyptic, amalgam fantasy. And he's basically doing his parents' accent. I also, when I'm doing Latina, I'm doing my mother's accent. And, the kid, like, I was like, I got you. I see you, bitch. I see you. I got you. The game is obviously met on many levels because the story of the game is Paradigm is also the name of the protagonist, is like a defective mutant adult who was part of a breeding program to make the perfect child. But then something went wrong where as soon as the perfect genetically engineered children hit puberty, they wanted to become artists, which is a parent's worst nightmare. And I was like,
oh geez. Yeah. Totally identify with that story, huh?
I'm like, Jacob, come on, be real with me. Your parents didn't get it when you said you wanted to do art, huh? And he's like, no.
Oh geez. So sad.
And obviously Paradigm is him working out that issue. Obviously you're when you make personal art, even if you think it's removed from you, it's not. You only write what you know. because that's
very therapeutic in the end, right? Yeah, even something as silly as, like, we talk about it all the time on the show, something as silly as making podcasts, it's been our therapy for 7 years, just to put out content and you know, talk to each other about the stuff we love. And just, like, you know, without it, I think we probably all, there's three of us that make the show, we would have gone crazy by now. Over the course of 7 years. But yeah, I mean, you're right. It is, there's something very therapeutic and cathartic about putting stuff out there. And I'm sure, you know, Paradigm, the makers of Paradigm, felt the same way.
Yeah, well, a basic tenet of humanity is we will die out without community. Even in your community can be small, but you will suffer, die sooner, blah, 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 without some sort of tribalism going on a basic level. And the point of story and narrative is humans trying to cope with their existence and make it make sense, which is why, like, across the board, like, if you're watching American Gods on Stars right now, which I think is doing a great job, American Gods is an idea of gods are made real because people thought them into existence, and it's all people just trying to cope with their day-to-day lives and working their shit out. That's why gods exist, and that's why we have religion, and that's why across the board so many creation myths have extremely similar plot points.
I love that you said that. I was a history teacher for a while, and that was one of the things I always pushed, was that the fact that those creation myths all have very, very similar plot points, and, you know, they all have the flood story, they all have the creation myth. It's really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's how we get by, and that's how we can cope with things like grief and love and loss and winning and losing. Like, it's the only way we work our shit out. Like, there's never been a script written that wasn't the writer trying to work out their personal problems. I said that, I was tweeting about that, and Chris Latoie, who I met through, he wrote for Dawngate, which was a canceled MOBA by EA, and he also happened to write a good chunk of Mass Effect 2, and I was tweeting about this, and he jumped in, and he's like, a good chunk of the script Mass Effect 2 was me trying to work out my issues with my son.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's one of my favorite games of all time, by the way. I love Mass Effect 2.
Of course. Back to Paradigm, I was like, so your parents didn't get it, right? And he's like, no, and Jacob made this game by himself. He hired a sound designer, composer, but even Jacob took on a lot of sound design roles. Jacob directed me over Skype and, like, was editing and implementing audio, self-directing, all this stuff. A first-time game dev.
That's awesome. That's really, really impressive.
The workload that this, I mean, when I say he's a child, I'm not trying to be demeaning. He's incredibly young in his career. He's incredibly young in his bones. And he took on a workload that most older people I know wouldn't do, because it's too much,
right.
But he took it on swimmingly, and
that's awesome.
And it's done well for him.
Is Paradigm available now?
Yes. It's out
so
now.
So if you're listening, is it on Steam?
Yes, it is.
Get it on Steam, everybody. Support him and his therapeutic game making.
Yeah, but you know, he worked on it for 3 years straight and did it the right way. He's a smart cookie. Will not be a starving artist. Did it from home, lived with his parents, and his parents seeing what he was putting into it, and then also, like, being able to see the game itself and see his world building. They slowly came around with, like,
oh, that's great. So it has a happy end.
Yeah, well, because it's very difficult to convince other people. I mean, and this is an incredibly universal experience. Everybody who works in entertainment, games, animation, whatever artistic endeavor, if your family or parents come from a traditional old world mentality or thinking, or they've all been, you know, accountants or something, and you're the first one who wants to be an animator, you're going to have a hard time making them compassionate to your being the black sheep. I was a game developer prior to being a voice actor, and it wasn't until I was like 60, and I got my foot in the door when I was 18 too, which is pretty exceptionally young nowadays. Usually they want,
absolutely.
There's so many school programs and stuff now that they didn't have when I was younger. They usually expect you to come out with, like, a game design degree, and they usually start at, like, age 21, 22. So my entire adult life, 18 onwards, was spent working with developers in games. And it wasn't until, like,
I read it was 12 years, right? You worked as in dev, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing you survived, like, and you still are, like, a happy person. Most people that work in dev that long kind of lose their minds a little bit.
I did pretty well. I'm only one divorce in.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. But even, like, husband number two is, he's a, a game dev burnout. He's only 6 years into his career. He's younger than me. He's quite young. He's what, 29 in a month. And he now works in post-production, but he is like, he's got the dream job. He works at a post-production house, which also ironically, he works at the exact same studio where I recorded the bulk mass of Mass Effect hat.
Oh, wow. That's great.
This town is super small, but, Formosa Interactive, like a lot of other post houses, provides contract audio for game developers. Like Formosa has done all the Uncharted series, and they work with a ton of other developers as well. So he gets to work laterally on franchises that he likes, but not being in house, which is a big difference.
So he doesn't probably have to suffer through all that wonderful crunch and all that stuff, huh?
There's crunching, but it's crunched responsibly because the people at this post, there are some former developers, or a couple other developers that I know there as well, and they don't want to repeat those habits because they know what it results in. They've all got families, they've got kids.
right yeah. I mean, that's like I worked in dev a couple years back, and you know, there was a long period, I think it was like six months of crunch, or maybe 5 months of crunch on a game, and everyone just got really unhealthy, like physically unhealthy, because people were there till like 2 a.m. and like,
of course,
you know, I gained like 25 pounds from crunch food. Like, it was just like, it was intense. And
stress,
I know people
will
do
kill
it.
You. It yeah. will kill you. And never yeah. mind dissolve your relationships and whatever else. And with my first husband's he's a lead 3D modeler on Heroes of the Storm. He's been at Blizzard for, oh my God, like coming up on 10 years, and he's going to be a lifer over there.
Yeah.
And we were both like, he got into Blizzard when we were both 24, and we were just like, the priority was always the job and like ladder climbing that social strata. And like, and as a result, like the way I describe it is my relationship with my first husband is exactly the same now as it was during our marriage, where we're very cordial and stuff. We're very like into our own, you know, our own pockets of like, these are the things I have to do. I'll see you when I see you.
Right.
Which is not a relationship make, but I know a lot of marriages in game dev were like that because everyone's so focused on ladder climbing, whether it's ladder climbing with salaries or titles or jumping around to get your name on different credits. And it's a real
rat
race.
You have to kind of ask yourself in the end, which is I'm sure something that you did, like, wait, like, why am I doing this? If the end result is happiness, right? The end result of any job should be putting food on the table and being happy. If all I'm doing is grinding, and in the end I'm not happy, then what the hell am I doing? Like, why am I spending, you know, 18 hours at this place every day? So I think that's what happens to a lot of devs. They're just like, wait a second. Like, I am spending my life building this thing, which is awesome. And it's wonderful to have this, you know, grand creative project, which is, you know, sometimes something that hundreds of people work on. But in the end, it's like, if you go home and you're miserable at the end of the day, because you're tired and you don't see the people you love, then what's the point, you know?
The best way I've seen it explained is on Twitter. Once I saw someone just talking about people putting themselves through the meat grinder, and whatever it is, like there's many horror stories of people working in visual effects houses on films, working insane hours and stuff and being paid nothing because ultimately a vendor is selling a cheap bottom line to a film studio to pay a check to get visual effects in their film at whatever cost. And those are great revolving door meat grinders for students, for example. And the best way I saw someone put it is that like a 22-year-old kid will be like, but it's Star Wars. And a 22-year-old kid will kill themselves for Star Wars and will not, a young person will not have any regard for their health or relationships or even being paid appropriately because it's Star Wars. As an example, not that franchise in particular, but any big name franchise or director or whatever property that you can be a part of, if you're not prioritizing your wellness, you will kill yourself for it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know you've told the story many times about, you know, your transition from dev to voice acting. So was it the fact that you were starting to feel burnt out, or was it just, you know, you realized that you had this sort of untapped talent and decided to go ahead and use it? Like, what made you want to switch over?
I got put into a position that I didn't want to be in. I had been, the majority of my dev career was very, very spoiled. I was always in publisher houses. Like, I started at Sony Online, during the heyday of EverQuest, which I played your work then. I didn't work. I mean, I started as a game master. I was the game master of Rod Set Knife, and did all the, and I co-worked all the fanfares and all that stuff. And
that is so cool. That is so cool.
I played eventually, that came out. Yeah. That was also my therapy. And then eventually, they opened up an audio department to support EverQuest 2. And that's how I got my foot in the door, because they needed an entry level person just to implement VO, because they couldn't keep up. Because it was, at the time, the most ambitious project in games for VO. They wanted to push 100,000 lines of VO. Everyone in LA still has trauma about it. If you bring up EverQuest, or EverQuest 2, they'll twitch, because even casting directors ended up doing voices, because they just ran out of voices.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was nuts. I was a little 24. I should back up. So I got the job and did implementation. EverQuest 2 shipped, but you know, it slowed down. I was nervous, and I'm like, I don't think I have job security. So I begged them, and again, because this is before the days of too many schools, one of the leads took me on and mentored me, who I'm forever grateful to, and let me become a sound designer. Then I became a full-fledged sound designer of the team. And so I got to be a little 24-year-old shit driving to Burbank from San Diego and overseeing co-directing sessions for ongoing EverQuest 2 work. And now, like, those are people that I see at callbacks who remember me, which is really funny now.
That is awesome.
which is a bit surreal and weird. But they were, you know, I was the client, and also like vendors and stuff, even like Formosa, who I mentioned earlier. Like, I have a relationship with Formosa because from Sony Online, I worked at Obsidian, and Formosa was the vendor for the canceled Aliens RPG. So like, I used to be the client and person who was getting their contract signed, and now I just, like, you know, show up for work there and get harassed. So that's my job now.
It's crazy how life does that to you, though. Sometimes, like, shifting careers is the weirdest thing ever, and then all of a sudden when they start crossing over again later on in life, it's even weirder. But it's cool that you were able to do that. I mean, a lot of people would just stay in dev and not even, you know, try and make the transition. And it's neat that you decided to make such a big shift. And I mean, I know we've had a lot of voice actors on the show before, and it is it's almost like being a small business owner. Like, you have to kind of go out there and sell yourself. And I am an
independent business owner. I own the business of me.
Yeah, absolutely.
100%. What actually blows my mind is how many, this is really scary to me. So I mean, I did freelance audio for a couple years between working at Turtle Rock and Obsidian. So I had to, it just seemed like nobody told me to do this. I didn't look up tutorials, and I didn't really talk to people that I should have. It seemed a good idea to me to, like, track my invoices and track when I did a job and who I did it for and what I agreed that they would pay me and how long it's been, blah, 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 blah. So when I became a voice actor, it just seemed, also for tax purposes, because you have to, you know, in the United States, you have to claim your income, because sometimes people pay you the gross amount and they don't take out withholding. So I am responsible for paying those taxes at the end of the year.
Right.
No one else is going to keep track for me. There are so many voice actors who don't write down who they worked for, when they worked, what the payment was going to be, which agency it was through, did they use an agent, da 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 da. And in VO world, you can only start asking where's my money after 90 days. If someone pays you within 90 days of the session, it's still considered in good faith.
Oh, wow.
At any given time, during the calendar year, I have money that's owed to me way past 90 days. I've had people pay me checks like 6-9 months late. And the only bullet I have in the chamber is they'll ask for more work, and I have to say, no, you have to pay me for the thing from 6 months ago.
See, it's interesting, because you basically now have to, not only are you, you know, you're in the business of yourself, but you have to learn also how to take care of yourself and make sure people don't take advantage of you, which is a thing a business would have to do. So it's really interesting. And it also means that you have to hustle, and you have to, you know, put yourself out there pretty much constantly. I loved your website. Your website has like an insane amount of information, especially if you are like a budding voice actor. You have just like, I don't even know how many, like dozens of informative links on like what you can do if you want to learn about voice acting, if you want to do it yourself. And I thought that was cool that you took the time to help out other people that are kind of moving into the field, because it's kind of this weird nebulous thing, right? And I think just in recent years, the popularity of certain voice actors and also the quality of work has improved so much over the past decade. I think people now, young people, are being like, well, this is something that I might actually want to do as a career. So the fact that you have the info out there is pretty cool.
I just hate repeating myself. People are too lazy to Google. Like, look, no, I didn't go to anybody, and ask how do I do it, and I didn't Google or anything. I did absolutely have the benefit of, because when I was on the client side, I understood at least the assembly line and how the sausage. And now I fully understand the assembly line sausage is made, because I've played nearly every part, short of being like maybe the engineer during a sound session, because I haven't worked for a post production house. But I had a clue when how to go about, and also I Googled. But a lot of people are very lazy and they want a free handout, and so I get the regular. So how do I do it? Do you have any tips? And I'm like, here,
right.
And also like, to me, that's also a big indicator when they bother asking. It's like, you didn't even bother going to my website first. You still came to me first for a handout, but here you go.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been to a panel on voice acting without the first question being, well, how do I become a voice actor? You're like, really? There's a lot of information out there if you take 35 seconds to look it up.
People want shortcuts. They want shortcuts and handouts. And yeah, those are the people who don't make it. And they get weeded out very, very quickly. Like, for example, the way I got an agent is that I knew that there's a website called Voice Bank, and that's where a lot of jobs get posted between clients and agents, and that gets disseminated out to actors. But I knew every agency in the world is listed there. So what did I do? I pulled up the search, and I pulled up every single agency in LA, and I cold called, emailed all of them. And then I got 10 responses back, and then ended up with the one I'm with now. But that's how that happened. Nobody told me to do that or how to do that. That just seemed to me like the logical thing to do. And yeah, I didn't drop any names or just be like, by the way, I come with 12 years of game developer experience or whatever. I was very, just very, very plain about, here are my demos. I'm financial core. Here's my website. I speak Spanish. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to ask you really quickly about Financial Corp, and we're going to, just for a minute, it's going to be very shop talky here for our listeners, but I found it really interesting just because I find voice acting very interesting. So can you tell our listeners just a little bit about what Financial Corp is, just sort of like the abbreviated nutshell of what that is?
Sure. Financial Corp is based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision. It affects all labor unions in the United States. The way labor unions work is that you belong to the union. Every job you do, the union gets a cut. And then out of that money pot supposedly comes out your benefits, whether it's your health benefits or programs to benefit union members or club outings, whatever. As a result of that, whatever union you belong to, you're not supposed to take non-union jobs. I'm in it for the money. So I want to do non-union work openly, non-hypocritically, and I want the extra change that comes from that. So the way that you can do that with whatever union in the United States, what you do is, when you are part of the union, you send in, and you can Google this, there's a boilerplate letter so that it's legally sound, that basically says, I, Frieda Wolf, from this day forward, wish to become Financial Corp with this union. I understand the consequences. Thank you very much. And you sign. And then it is the union's duty to send you a letter back saying, we acknowledge your FICOR, your Financial Corp status. Thank you very much. You are now a dues paying non-member. And that's very important. So the legalese for a Financial Corp member is dues paying non-member. So,
okay. So you pay,
I pay dues.
The SAG dues.
Is sanctioned the right word? I am permitted to do union jobs, and the union still takes the same cut that they take out of every union actor. But I'm permitted to openly do non-union work, which the union cannot touch. I still get union health benefits if I make enough money in order to qualify for union health benefits. Union insurance is cute. You have to make $17,000 in union jobs per quarter. Okay. If you get sick and make less than that money, you lose the insurance when you need it.
Oh, that's terrible. Sick. Jeez Louise.
Yeah, it's kind of worthless. Kind of worthless. Also, like, I get, I still get residuals. Residuals are most commonly in whatever still makes it to broadcast television. So, like, for example, a commercial, I get paid for the time in the booth. But if the commercial makes it to air, every time it's paid to air in a cycle, I get money for that residual cycle, for example, or like an animated show that makes it to air, for example. Things that make it to the internet, there's no residuals. Nobody tracks that viewership.
Avatar ride plays, do you...
every time that 20-minute loop, I could retire.
There you go. Starts raining down from the heavens.
Yeah, that'll never happen. Yeah. So that's what Financial Corp means. And the point of doing that is, if it is not unheard of for union actors to go do non-union work anyway. The problem with that is if you get caught, it's a big to-do. You go before a panel and they fine you thousands of dollars and they yell at you and threaten you with expulsion from the union and blah, blah, blah. And I don't need that. I'd Wow. much rather be a dues-paying non-member and, you know, give my cut to the king and continue to work. And then also happily, openly do my non-union work and whatever, and everybody's happy.
So yeah, it seems like a very logical choice. I mean, it sounds like you're kind of getting the best of both worlds if you're not worried about the accolades and all that mumbo jumbo.
Yeah. The trade-off is because I'm a dues-paying non-member, I am not a member of the club. I can never run for SAG president or treasurer or secretary, like any of those student body class president roles. I'll never be nominated for a SAG award. I won't get DVD screeners in the mail for my consideration for
awards
for free. And then again, like I mentioned, part of that pot money is supposed to go towards things that benefit union members, like club meetings, special presentations. I don't get to go to those. I just get to work, and I'm only in it for the work. Really?
There you go. There's nothing wrong with that. Well, we had a question from Twitter, and this is kind of transitioning over to some Mass Effect stuff. This is from Paul Jason Meyer, who's at Mulwin444 on Twitter, and he says, "How did you end up getting the Andromeda gig?" And I know the answer to this, and it's a pretty cool story. But if you wouldn't mind telling the story of how you ended up getting the job, that would be cool.
Well, in simplest terms, a lot of people have adorably asked, so what attracted you to the role? Like, what made you want it? The money.
It's a million pages of work.
Yeah, but also I didn't know what I auditioned for. We being voice actors, we get depending on the day, some to none to a bunch of emails every day from our agents, and those emails are auditions, and we're expected to record them at home and send them back, and then do the ones for the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And I described the job. The job is to audition, and once in a while I get paid for it. Like, some people get hung up on is it really hard being rejected? Does it hurt your feelings? No, because that is the gig. The gig is being rejected 90% of the time. You win the acting game when you are paying your bills and you have stuff left over and you're not in the red. You won. That's it. Like, that should be your bar that you set. That should be your accolade. Like, if you're chasing awards, you're an asshole. You're a dumb asshole, because that stuff is so out of your hands. Like,
I think it's that way with almost every creative endeavor, right? If you can create something or do the thing that you kind of like to do and make enough money to eat, then you have won the game.
You can't really pick your career aside from being a fine artist. But if you work for other people, if you're a comics artist and you work for DC and Marvel, you are their servant. Versus if you make your own independent comic, then that's great. But most likely, as an example, and I mean, I know plenty of comic book artists and writers who, you know, do full-time proper work for DC, Marvel, IDW, Image, whoever, and that provides, and then they're like, okay, I'm off limits for the next few months. I'm going to work on my own thing. And then it's that balance, because again, you win the game when you're not starving and you can pay your bills. That's it. That's
right.
So I'm winning, cause I can pay my bills, and that's great.
That is great.
So with Mass Effect, like anything else, it was an audition. I didn't know what I was auditioning for. EA has a bunch of dummy scripts that they have sent out for years, to the point where I actually found I had auditioned with the exact same script in 2014.
Oh, wow.
And then the audition that booked me writer for Mass Effect, was in 2015, and with the exact same script. And I listened to them together, and you can hear my growth in a year of, so much better and so much less stiff and way more natural. And I'm like, I wouldn't have hired me in 2014 either. I wouldn't hire that
person. It's amazing. I mean, just all that consistent work and, basically, auditioning all the time, probably just keep improving your craft over time.
You can only get better especially at a creative thing. You can't, short of a physiological problem, like suffering a stroke or something, God forbid, you can't really get worse at this. You can only get better. Really, even in small increments, you will get better. So Andromeda was just an audition that I didn't know what I was auditioning for, whatever. And then, especially video game jobs are coded. People ask this a lot, and just games are in a league of their own. when you go do an animated show or anything animated, you always get the script at least the night before. You're expected to read it and to have digested it and to have opinions and to have ideas about your character and even questions or whatever, and to go in prepared. Video games, 90% of the time, we don't know what we're working on. They're codenamed. You're just given a time and a date and a studio to show up at, and that's it. And even then, I've worked on games where I still don't know what it is. I might know the publisher because that's where the paycheck comes from. And then I have to follow up later and be like, oh, that's what it was. Okay.
After this stuff drives me crazy too. Why do you think that is? And it's like, it's funny, but like actors in television and film, as soon as the project is announced, the people working on it, the talent attached to it, they're announced as well. But in games, it's the absolute opposite. Like, you know, voice actors record for sometimes years, mm-hmm. and then it's not even announced until like the week the game comes out who's attached to it. And I wonder, like, why do you think that is? Like, is it
we can't have nice things. Some people have we can't have nice things. Some people have leaked scripts. They've leaked scripts for animated shows. They've leaked scripts for games, and I don't know why people do. I think people get off on that really quick adrenaline hit of like, I'm so cool, I leaked a thing on the internet, not thinking long-term consequences of like, if that gets back to you and they find out who did that, you are done in this business.
Yeah, period. Absolutely. So you think it's just mainly for security reasons that voice actors are oftentimes kind of like, you know, like the fact their attachment is not even like, it's not even mentioned until almost the time the game comes out.
Publishers are paranoid.
Yeah.
Because again, we just can't have nice things. It only takes one person to do it per year to remind publishers why they're justified in doing it. And it does happen every freaking year.
Yeah, that's true. Fallout
4 was leaked because somebody shared scripts with Kotaku. Why?
Oh, yeah, that's true. I forgot about that.
For example. So I just got the time and date and I showed up at the studio and it was at Formosa and I knew the engineers. I've known those guys a long time. So the two people running the session were behind the glass. The client wasn't there. They were like, oh, the client's going to Skype in. I'm like, what is this? They're like, I don't know. So the client Skypes in and it's Caroline Livingstone from Edmonton.
Yes.
She's like, hi, Frida. So nice to meet you. So welcome to Mass Effect. You're the hero player. You're the player. All right, let's get started. And I was like, and I made this face at the engineers, like my jaw dropped. I'm like, what the fuck? And they're like, I don't know, man, you're on. I'm like, okay. She's like, okay, so let's get started. So there was no, like, I've said this in other interviews. I think part of, it's my coping mechanism, and I'm not going to tell other people how to behave at your workplace. Like, you do what you want, and you see how it works for you. But the reality of voiceover work specifically, it is a timetable, okay? The client has paid for X amount of time in the studio, whether it's 1 hour or up to 4 hours or whatever.
Right.
And then they got to get the fuck out. We all as a group have to get what we came to do, go from A to B to the end of the script so you can get your money's worth or somebody is in trouble. Someone will be in trouble. The actor will be in trouble if the actor's super slow, or maybe the booth director casting person who scheduled this session will be in trouble because maybe they underestimated how long it would take to record X amount of scripts. Maybe the studio will get in trouble because we're a lot of technical difficulties. So it took us an hour to get started. Somebody's head will roll if we don't get what we need to get done in 4 hours, because if we need to come back, it's going to cost money. And every time something costs more money, somebody is in trouble. I am extremely aware of this when I go into a session of like, okay, I am going to be, and it doesn't matter if I've never met you before, I'm going to be your best damn friend for the next 1 to 4 hours. Like, you have my full attention. You have all of my energy. I am here to serve you as a commercial artist. What do you need? Let's get it done. So I didn't have time to like have my, you know, princess pageant meltdown of like, oh my God.
Right. Yeah, you were just in work mode. I mean, that's pretty fantastic. They just broke it to you like that. Like, I mean, that is like, guys, it's just like unbelievable. You know, such a huge franchise with so many fans. And then all of a sudden to just be kind of like not even realize that you had gotten it and not even having the time to really react is just amazing.
So I was like, yeah, cool, whatever. Let's work. So we did work. And then I came out of that session and I called my agent and I was like, I called my agent first and I was like, hey, I think I misunderstood. And this is how my brain processed it. And my brain processed it this way for like a good 6 months into working. We recorded for like a year and a half plus.
Wow.
But for the first 6 months, this is what I told my job. I was like, I think I misheard. I think what this is I must be temp. I must be like, this is totally common. Like there's plenty of jobs that go out for this. Not so much for games, definitely for like animated films, for example, where they want a cheap, reliable workhorse voice actor to come in and record and read before they bring in the stunt casting, before they bring in the celebrity or something, just to see how the script feels. But they want someone who's competent, just not expensive.
So you didn't even realize that it was 100% you until way, way down the line.
I was in denial so that I could cope with it.
I would be the exact same way. I'd be like, there's no freaking way it's me.
Look, I'm nobody. I'm not a name. I'm not established. I haven't done enough protagonist work. I felt to justify shouldering me with this multi-million-dollar, extremely high expectation franchise. Right. I wouldn't trust me with it. So I was like, I think I misheard. I'm probably the temp. I'm probably the scratch. That happened. And that's what I told myself for the next 6 months. But also it just like, I can't, when you're working, like even down on a one-on-one basis. So I spent a lot of my VO training when I was investing in it with Richard Horvitz, who's the voice of Invader Zim and Chaos and Skylanders and a bunch of other stuff. And he's a great teacher. I highly recommend him for games and animation. And I spent time with him. And one day I came in for a private session and I just sort of told him, I was like, you know, I think I just stopped wagging my tail for you. Because I was such a fangirl of Invader Zim and stuff.
Awesome. Every time
he came in, I was aware that I was like, hi, Richard! And just like wanting to please like a puppy dog, which that's not working. Because now this is very heady actorship. But like the thing that makes good acting is if you're always anchored into what the character wants and that drives the performance. If you know what you want or you know what you want from someone else in your scene or whatever, then you know what to do. You know how to feel. Everything you do is right. If you know what you want and you're specific about it. And up until that point, what I wanted from Richard, I think was like, you know, fandom approval. And then I came in and I was like, you know, I think I just stopped wagging my tail for you. And he's like, great. Now we can do real work. So in the same way with like, working for Mass Effect, I can't come in every day and be like, guys, did you know it's Mass Effect? It's me. It's
right,
Mass Effect.
Yeah.
I'm going to do so many interviews and podcasts I'm going to be late for because I watched Aliens and I'm going to go to commit.
You're instantly forgiven. I did tell Matt right before you showed up, though. I told Matt, I'm like, we haven't had a no-show in years. I'm like, this would be weird.
I have an Aliens hangover.
It's completely fine.
Like, you can't. So you can't get hung up on, which is also why I think why I said like awards chasing is stupid, because you're putting the cart before the horse. You still have to do the work. Or I've gone in to do animated shows, and like a freaking, for me, a celebrity is there like someone whose work I've grown up watching and liking, or somebody who is like a really handsome celebrity actor. I've sat in the lobby across from Mark Hamill twice now.
Oh boy.
But because he's just another voice actor too. He's just doing his work. I've parked him and it's like my, but I can't. But you know, there's a time and a place to be enthusiastic and have your fandom blow out and whatever. And that time and place is never at a voice studio when you got to get work done ever. So like, you know, if I'm working with someone like a celebrity person like in an animated show or whatever, I'm just like, hey, so nice to meet you. I'm Frida, and I'm pretending I have no idea who you are. Because I don't want to make you uncomfortable, and we have to do work, and I don't want to make you feel weird.
Well, I did want to tell you, I finished Andromeda, and I felt like your work was absolutely spectacular. I loved your job that you did, and I just said, you know, people don't hear it enough, but I really feel like you did a spectacular job.
Thank you very much. I tried.
Yeah, you did really well. There was a lot of dialogue in that game. I think I put myself 80 plus hours into it, and you know, and. Thanks. I don't think there were any, none of the deliveries. I was like, oh, that was bad. I think you did a really, really solid job.
Thank you.
I have a quick question for you. I started doing improv about a year and a half ago, and you mentioned on your site doing improv as a thing for voice acting as a way to begin. Where did you do improv out in LA or in San Diego or?
Yeah. So what I did is when I was working, which I didn't totally finish my transition story, but we'll circle back to that.
Sorry.
So no, not at all. There's so much, there's so much, there's so much aliens to still talk about. So when I was, my last sound design gig was at Turtle Rock for Evolve, which was a huge deal for me because Turtle Rock is the actual company that made Left 4 Dead. Valve bought it, paid for it, did the networking and multiplayer stuff, but Turtle Rock is the core team that made Left 4 Dead, and that game's a big monumental deal, especially Left 4 Dead changed a lot of stuff for how game audio is thought of in games, so I love those guys. So when I was, that's in Orange County, Irvine, and that's like in no traffic to LA, an hour's drive and peak traffic, almost 3 hours. Yeah. And for Evolve, I also got to co-direct some VO sessions and stuff like that. And because I'd been looped into, as a sound designer, I'd been looped into co-directing, casting, voice actors for games. I knew knowing how the sausage is made is really important. I think being on Twitter, unfortunately, I run into a lot of, I've learned consumers think they already know everything about how everything is made, films, right. games, whatever.
Yeah.
And they are happy to tell you or any other professional how you should have done it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can say that will really educate, resonate, or land with them. You just can't engage. You got to give up. So, for me, the importance of knowing how the sausage is made is everything. And I thought, you know, I think I'd be a better director if I understood what I was asking actors to do. And I know that I'm right now in hindsight because to this day, some of my favorite, best, most supportive directors I've had are people who are also working actors. Like Liam O'Brien has directed me a bunch of times, and he's a director. He knows he's not asking me to do anything that he wouldn't, you know, be willing to do himself, and he doesn't push me harder than right. he would be willing to be pushed. Stephanie Shea
super
is another.
I like Liam a lot. He's a super nice guy.
Liam's a great guy who deserves everything wonderful that happens to him. So does Stephanie Shea. Stephanie Shea was the first actor who ever sent me an audition, whoever booked me in LA, whoever gave me the time of day, even though I had nothing behind me.
Right.
And she's another really well-known supportive director because she's also a working actor. It really helps if you know, like it's rare to find, for example, a musical conductor who can't play an instrument. That would be fucked up.
That'd be weird.
That'd be
weird.
Yeah.
So it made sense to me of like, you know what? I should know what the hell I'm asking people to do so I can speak their language better. So on a whim, I started going to LA. I took a bunch of different VO classes. Like I said, I spent some time with Richard Horvitz. He does amazing, great group classes. And then I did all 4 credits of Upright Citizens Brigade improv. Awesome. I went to UCB because they're considered the new school. That's Amy Poehler and the rest of the Upright Citizens Brigade school. And I kind of wanted to do the new school. It was a super great brain-breaking experience. It blew me open because prior to that, I don't think I really trusted my gut and understood how much of acting is reacting, and you hear that a lot, but it doesn't make sense until you do it. And that just means being so reactive that you are improv teaches you that your job is to make your scene partner look good.
Yeah.
And you are in your head and obsessing about what you're going to say, which a lot of people get weird and culty and religious about improv because it applies so much to real life.
Yes.
It really, in the same way that we were talking earlier about how like story and narrative and religion and all those things are how human beings work out their shit. It's how we cope with the real world. Improv is an extension of that because it is a form of storytelling. And in life, like for example, if you go to couples therapy ever, the very first thing they make any couples do is they have one person tell the partner something and then make the other partner say, okay, now say back verbatim what they said. And right. instead of doing that, you repeat an interpretation of what you wanted to hear or what you think they meant, but you will not repeat the words verbatim because you were so busy thinking about a reply and interpreting it.
Interesting.
To the words. You can't, and that's an exercise. Like if you have a partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever, try that with them. It is so freaking hard to do at first because, like a big indicator, like for example, when you're talking to someone and they start talking over you, that's because they were never listening to anything you said and they were only preparing the reply and they can't wait any longer because they got to tell you what you were thinking because what you were saying doesn't matter to them. So, and you can't do that in improv, right? Like in improv, you can't talk over people because you are very loudly at that point expressing, I don't care what you're saying. I don't care about your idea. I don't care about where you're steering the scene. Here's my great idea.
Yeah,
ta-da!
Yeah. Yeah, like 9 times out of 10, it's the guy who's already thought of his like his joke before, like he's like, oh, I know, I've got a punchline I'm gonna do.
Exactly. That's life too, when you're like, yeah, but listen to my day.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. And that just leads to problems, right? So improv teaches you your job is to make your scene partners look good, and if everybody adheres to that, it goes right, it goes well. Everybody feels good, like they did something that they made something together. It teaches you to listen, and it also teaches you to like sit back, relax, and react. And what that means is whatever your gut instinct is the correct one, because you are having a real human emotion without overthinking it. The best articulation of that I can think of is like Richard Horvitz, in one of his classes said, so when you go have lunch with your friend, do you rehearse the lunch in the mirror? Like, do you rehearse the conversation and what you're going to talk about? Do you watch your face to see what kind of faces you're going to make? No, because it's weird and hammy and strange and inhuman and unnatural. You don't do that. You go have lunch with your friend and you have a conversation, and whatever comes up and however you react is how you spend your day. That's what acting should be like. Yeah. You should have a gut instinct, and then you should run with that and trust that it's the right one because it's the one that's coming from you. Right. So with like Mass Effect, especially with, oh my God, those scenes that go four different ways.
Right.
We would do every scene and then go back to the top and then go back through it. BioWare has it down to a science. That it's not their first run. They've done this before. And the reason their VO is better than Lott's is because they always make sure that even if they haven't recorded the other characters in that scene where they can pipe in the VO and like, let me, you know, respond to them, the director will at least read with me like a screen test.
So it makes you feel a lot more organic and a lot more real. Yeah.
Conversation with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also I can see the full conversation. Like, I can't tell you how many games are out there that for some reason they think it's a good idea. Aside from, games like MOBAs and FPSs and shooters and anything multiplayer where we're not really talking about story doesn't matter because it's grenade, get the tower. Like, we don't need context or story for that. We get it. Fine. You don't need to tell me, you know, what my relationship with my family is in order for me to yell grenade. Cool. But when we're having a conversation with somebody in a scene, there have been games where they only send me my lines. And no one in the session.
Yeah, that makes for a pretty rough conversation.
So then you go home and then you plug that in and you have two different people talking at each other like funny robots, like Alexa and the other one, you know, going on forever, talking in different tones, not responding to each other. And that loses little sensitive things of realism, like, you know, one person's yelling at your face and the other one's talking quietly. That's weird. It's funny. It's
right,
awkward.
Yeah. You can always tell, especially these days when time wasn't taken to record the VO correctly in a large game, you're like, oh, they just didn't really give a shit. Cause when the delivery is flat like that, it is very, very apparent, especially now as I've, you know, started to really pay attention as I've gotten older. You can always tell when it was rushed.
Of course. Or just like, there's no context. Like,
right. Like you said, it's just like two robots talking to each other.
Yeah, which is why the dream for everybody in VO, the absolute dream is to be invited to do full performance capture, like what they can do for Naughty Dog and stuff like that, where you perform in a volume, you perform in a stage in your little wetsuit with your balls on you. But that is the closest to performing live theater that voice actors ever get, because you're with people. And that makes all the difference in the world. And there's no replicating that. You can get close with piping in VO or having someone read with you, but like, there's no replicating live theater. That the privileged few get to do that. And any voice actor who says they prefer to work alone than work with people isn't really an actor.
That's a really good point. Well, we're starting to run low on time, but I do want to ask you some silly lightning round questions. Are you prepared for them?
Yes, but I kept threatening to circle back to my transition.
Oh, yeah. No, please.
Real quick. So what happened was I got fired from Turtle Rock, but with good reason. So my whole sound design career, I was really cushy, and I always had the benefit of an audio programmer. When you have an audio programmer on your team, they can help not only with implementation of audio into the game, but they can also help with tools. So I was always spoiled with visual tools. I never had to do any back-end coding whatsoever. Huh. And at Turtle Rock, for the first time in my like 9 years of audio, I was forced to script in Lua. And I hated it so much. And I was just like, I don't want to get better at this, guys. I don't I don't want, because bless the programmers. And if you're looking to get into game audio, if you are willing and enthusiastic even about scripting in any capacity, you will have an edge over those who are lazy like me. I should have definitely been in more of a post-production role, throwing audio over the wall so I wouldn't have to do any back-end stuff, because code is so rewarding when you get it right. But when you don't, and it's dumb shit, like you were off by a bracket in a notepad and you have to hunt that down. I wasn't happy doing it. So I just sort of like curled up and waited to die. And the owners were very understanding. It was a total mercy kill. The owners are still very paternal towards me and always checking up on me. I mean, to the point, they ended up casting me for Evolve. I'm Kyra in Evolve, and also doing tens, hundreds of hours of tutorial work. So we're like, we're totally cool. But,
oh, yeah, that's great.
But I had to get like fired out, edged out at age 30 for me to just kind of sit and reevaluate and think about,
make that change.
Do I want to do this? Because I'm not happy doing this, and I know it's something that I need to do if I want to advance at my job, and I don't want to do it. So what does that mean? And up until that point, I'd been going to LA for VO stuff for 4 years, on and off, casually as a hobby at night. Again, not a starving artist. I didn't have to make it work for me. I was doing it with a full-time job. So when this all happened, I was like, oh shit, I have like 4 years of education, of VO education before. I think I know what I'm doing. I think I could be a voice actor. And the transition was awesome. Really quick, and I started working right away. I had no problems getting an agency once I had my demos done, and the rest is history. And then I got Mass Effect 3 years later, and I'm now April was my 4 year anniversary of being a full time voice
that's
actor.
Awesome.
Well, congratulations.
It feels like,
that's really
it feels
cool.
Like sometimes that's what's required, is that like push out the door. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like you're just standing there with your parachute on and you're not going to jump out of the plane on your own. And someone's finally like, you know what, you should go, and just like kind of like pushes you to get.
I, it's important to me to circle back and to be really open and honest about like why I transitioned. Cause as much as it was a conscious decision, I also needed to be told, look, you don't want to get better at this, and you are unhappy,
right,
and we can't solve that problem for you. What's it going to take for you to be happy? Because obviously like I was competent and enthusiastic, and games are an extremely important medium to me, but how can I better serve them? So now, I mean, I do exactly the job I want to do. I show up for the party and I leave. I produce assets with my mouth like a sound designer. I work with sound designers every day. I've worked with more developers, more sound designers, more audio directors, more programmers now as a voice actor, because my jobs rotate so quickly versus being housed in one place, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years at a time, where you get trench warfare vision, where all you see is just you and everybody else in the foxhole till the game gets done, and your world is very small and isolated.
Yeah.
I've worked with more people and built more relationships more quickly than I ever could have in-house. So I definitely ended up where I belonged. And that's a happy ending.
That's awesome.
It is a happy ending.
It did take them booting me out of the plane.
Yeah.
It has to happen sometimes, you know. Well, okay. So our lightning round questions, they're stupid. Answer them as quickly as you'd like. And then when you're done with these, you can go run free on your Sunday.
What? And look at you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to look up more alien stuff.
That's fine. I'll probably go see the movie and then look up more alien stuff too. So first question is, what is the first movie you remember seeing in the movie theater?
In the movie theater? Maybe Jurassic Park.
Oh, awesome. That's a good one. Yeah, that's a really good one.
No, actually, I'll lie. Pippi Longstocking.
I remember that. Awesome. Yeah.
I was like 6 or something, but it made a big impression on me because it was a girl protagonist who did whatever she wanted. She could eat ice cream at midnight, and she had a horse and a monkey, and that was the dream.
There's a fun fact about me and Pippi Longstockings. I went to see that with my mom. I was also very young. It was also playing at the same time as a film called Mac and Me, which was an E.T. ripoff, and we went to a double feature. We saw Pippi Longstockings and Mac and Me on the same day.
Which is the movie that Paul Rudd trolls Conan O'Brien with.
Yes! Oh my god, you know that movie. Okay, yeah. It's a terrible E.T. ripoff. Excellent. Next one is, would you get along with the 15-year-old version of yourself?
Oh, barely. Yes, because like I said, like huge movie, sci-fi, fantasy, nerd, dork. Just real quick, talking about like therapy and things that are good for yourself. A really good exercise is for you when you're in a tight situation and you're upset or whatever, is to just sort of like talk to your childhood self at whatever age you prefer, and just sort of like look at the trajectory of your life and where you're at now, and either be like, look, it's going to be okay, or say, you know what, I've messed up. Some stuff has gotten out of hand, but it's going to be fine. Because no matter what, again, like I was saying, you can only get better at being a voice actor or whatever your creative medium. You can kind of only get better as being a person because you have the benefit of experience.
Right.
So no matter what, you're still better off than your teenage self. You have that hindsight, whatever your feelings of your
It's a really
situation.
Good point. I think I've said this many times on the show, but I would probably punch my 15-year-old me in the face pretty hard. I was not a happy little 15-year-old, so I don't know if I would get along very well with me. But
I think my 15-year-old self was extremely, like I said, kind of repressed because my parents were not approving of me following an artist trajectory. Oh, I meant right. to say, like, my dad didn't acknowledge my work in games until there was a multiple page spread in Newsweek about EverQuest, maybe 6 years into my career. And he's like, oh, I guess you work for a real company. It's Sony. What do you want from me? So I think,
oh, parents.
Yeah, as far as my 15-year-old self, I would just be like, look, everything's going to turn out fine in a very roundabout way. You're going to end up working in entertainment with people you grew up watching on television, and then Mark Hamill's going to be around. What?
It's exciting.
What? It's going to be fine. It's going to be cool. It's going to be fine.
All right, next question is, you've been kidnapped. You can call on the characters from one television show to make a rescue attempt. Which show do you pick? And this is
Knight
one
Rider.
That we stole from the internet.
She's got, that was quick.
Knight Rider.
Knight Rider? Oh, yeah. Kit all the way.
Yeah.
Next question is, would you take a one-way trip to the Andromeda Galaxy?
It's hard to say no to. I'd probably die either on the way or there, but you would see some cool shit. Yeah, sure, why not? I mean, like, life is short and you're going to die anyway. And I think it's better if you actually have the option of choosing how and where you're going to die versus the uncertainty of just being stuck in this place.
Right, choking on a chicken bone. Like,
It'll be, you know what? Like, do you guys ever worry about, like, if you're going to die on the toilet?
I worry about that almost every time I go number two.
Yeah, it could happen. You can push too hard and have an aneurysm or something and they find you that way. And then someone's got to clean that up.
Someone's you want to know a fun fact? Fun fact is that Caucasian women are actually prone to spontaneous combustion on the toilet. So the most people that have died from spontaneous human combustion are women on the toilet.
What?
So what are they lighting up? Are they smoking on the toilet? Is that the one place they have privacy?
I don't know why I know that. That is a thing. Yeah, that's a thing. next question is, if you could only eat one food for the rest of your life, what food would you eat?
Sushi.
Sushi.
Okay. That's a variety. I mean, you can get away with that answer because there's a lot of different sushi, but it's a good
sushi is also a cheat, like pizza, because you can put anything on a pizza and still call it pizza, right?
That's true. That's actually the next question is about pizza. It's funny you brought that up. The perfect pizza is one topped with blank.
Can I only choose one topping?
You can do like a combo if you'd like.
I was going to say one topping is upsetting. My perfect pizza, I'm a mushroom and olive nut. I can't have enough of, if you put mushrooms, you can put mushrooms on garbage and I'll eat it and say it's good because I love mushrooms. Mushrooms, olive, onion, and some kind of meat, maybe a sausage.
Good. It's a good answer.
Yeah.
Sounds tasty. It's actually making me hungry. And the last question is, you are stranded on a desert island and a small box washes up on shore. What is inside that box?
Cats!
To be your friend or to eat?
Yes!
That is a perfect ending. Frida, thank you so much for being on our show. This was episode 273. Where can people find you on the internet and social media?
With my weird name, FrydaWolff. That is both my Twitter handle and my website. I am, to date, the only Frida, FryDa, in voice acting. If I find another one, I will dispose of her.
That's a good answer. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This was an absolute blast.
Thank you for having me and tolerating my aliens hangover. May you also enjoy your aliens hangover as you try to understand what you watched.
I'm going to try and go tomorrow. We'll see.
Do it. Do it. Then tell me what you think.
All right. All right, so that was our chat with Freda Wolf. It was awesome, man. She had a whole lot of really interesting things to say about voice acting and game dev and just, you know, Mass Effect. I don't know. I really, and also Aliens.
Yeah, and Aliens. It's always great. It's always great when we get somebody on that's just like, you know, they kind of just like, you can kind of sit back in the chair and just have a conversation with them. Like it just becomes so easy to talk to. And she's definitely one of those guests that just like, we haven't talked to her previous to this moment. And she just jumped on and was like, hey, let's talk about Aliens. Let's do this. And it was such an easy breezy conversation.
Yeah, she was a very easy guest to have on the show. And one that hopefully comes back in the future. I would Absolutely. Love to talk to her more. She has a lot of stuff to say about very interesting things. And I know I said it earlier in the show, but the fact that she comes from a development background and she has so much insight into voice acting and you know, it as a career and also as a passion, I think it's great. And she's a fun person to chat with. So,
yeah, so
hopefully
much,
she comes back.
So much good advice and fun and entertaining. So I think it was a good one, Ash.
Thanks, man. Thanks for coming along.
Hey, no problem.
Yeah. So, thank you guys for listening. This was episode 273 of the Rated NA podcast. We are sorry for the little bit of delays we've been having, but you know, Scott's moving. Life's moving. My kid turned one. It's been crazy.
We've been traveling. Stuff's happening, you know?
It's been crazy. Yeah. It's, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, but it is, sometimes you need to take a week off to, make sure your shit's straight, you know?
That's all I try to do.
Yeah, get the straight shit. anyway, you guys can find us on Twitter, and that's at Nerd Appropriate. You can email us directly, and that's Matt, Scott, or Ash at nerdappropriate.com. We have a Twitch TV channel, which is twitch.tv/nerdappropriate, and Facebook/nerdappropriate as well. Any news? Oh, so I will be going to MegaCon this weekend in Orlando. So if you're in the Orlando area and you happen to listen to the show, say hi. I'll be trying to do some interviews and stuff there, but who knows if those will come through. But I will definitely be at Orlando MegaCon for a few days, running around talking to some folks. So,
and then I'll be at WWDC the next week after that.
And you're going to BookCon.
And I'm going to BookCon. So,
we'll have some cons to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk about them. But if you're at BookCon or if you're for some reason an Apple developer, then hit me up and we'll hang out. We'll talk. It'll be fun.
Sounds good. But again, thank you guys so much for listening. And we'll be back next week with all new stuff.
Yeah.
Later.
See you.
Stop recording.